Can you guys hear me okay? Sorry, this is ridiculous.
This is going as smoothly as a Ferrari strategy. I guess we're just going to have to downgrade our commentators. Can we get Crofty in?
Welcome to the Feeder Series podcast. Somewhat like a certain championship that we're covering in this episode, we are back for a final hurrah this year from a very extended break. For many reasons I won't bore you with, we haven't been able to cover 2023 as extensively as we did in 2022, but we are here now to shine a spotlight on the highest ranked Feeder Series championship around, Formula 2. I have Alex Jakes and Josh Revel join me for the second time this year, and we are cleverly recording this F2 review before the Abu Dhabi finale. So, a huge caveat here, we don't know who the 2023 champion is for sure, so let's cover both bases. Congratulations, Singapore Share, on your well-deserved title. How about that, Alex?
Unbelievable. What a worthy champ.
And congratulations, Fred Vesti, for bouncing back so well at Yas Marina. What a drive. Could you believe it, Josh?
I cannot, for the life of me, convey my disappointment in Teo. No, credit's due. Vesti overcame all the odds. He won all those races throughout the year. And he managed to win the championship despite having only two wheels on his wagon at Zandvoort. So kudos to him.
Well done both. Well done everybody for making it this far through quite an extensive year. And Alex, as I quite candidly say, we are recording before Abu Dhabi, which means you've just come back from Vegas via the UK to Abu Dhabi. One, how are you feeling? And two, how was Vegas?
Vegas was absolutely crazy. It was crazy. I think it was expected to be crazy. I am delighted to be on a different time zone, having been in another time zone, but I'm not whinging about the job because I have a rule of never whinging about the job because it's an unbelievable job. And fundamentally, I think that when you're a little bit jet lagged, what you need is the adrenaline shot of Formula 2. So I sometimes think that the thing that gets me through this job is the sheer adrenaline that I process on a Friday, Saturday and Sunday with F2. So, that's going to be my friend for making it to the end of the season.
Yeah, it has been a while since you had a chance to talk about it as well, as I alluded to. And the finale, Josh, which will probably have happened by the time this goes out, but we have Franco Colapinto and Paul Aron debuting. I know you probably have opinions on this, Josh, so I'm just going to let you loose about the future of Formula 2.
Oh, no. What makes you think I've got an opinion on Franco Colapinto, mate? It's not as if I've been vocal about this, haven't I? No, it'll be interesting to see how he goes. Wait, no, hang on. It was interesting to see how he went.
I believe he won both races on debut. Could you believe that?
Yeah, lapping the field, eh? And, fastest laps as well, despite being on wet tires throughout the whole race. It's just the brother's special, man. Regardless of how he did this weekend, it's more next year that I'm looking forward to, because I've always been high on the guy, which sounds very awkward taken out of context, but seriously though, anyone that's actually watched this guy race on the approach up the ladder was seriously impressed. I saw him first enough when he was in TRS, as I do with every driver I rep, when he came here, and he just was leagues ahead of his teammates. Almost won the championship, almost won the New Zealand Grand Prix despite not being in the best team. I was like, okay, I'm keeping an eye on this guy. And the entire time you look up, and it's even in junior series, you need to look at your teammates above the general competition. And you look at how Colapinto does against his teammates, who are all very damn good drivers. And it's amazing to see where he is in comparison. So it's exciting to see him in Formula 2, but then you also see that he was achieving all these results whilst not testing, because he never had enough money to test in the first place. It's like, okay, like exactly how far is he going to go here? Which is, you know, another sort of, you know, a little bit to add to my agenda of this guy's the biggest thing to come out of Argentina since Carlos Reutemann. Just hopefully he doesn't crumple as easily. But, you know, seriously though, we want the best drivers to ascend up the ranks. And Formula 2 next year, with Kimi Antonelli and Franco Colapinto, Rotomo Miazza, Zach O'Sullivan, and they're just the ones that are announced so far. And Dennis Hauger coming back. It's Formula 2 has always been good. 2024, though, will be terrible. I'm trying to reverse jinx this thing. So I am excited for what's to come. Regardless of what happened in Yas Marina, the double DNF was not good, but it's an exciting time to see some of these talents come through. And especially for Williams as well. You know, they got a choice, Antonelli or Colapinto.
There's so much. We will talk about 2024 a little bit more as well, but 2023 as a whole, it is a review show, and we will go through the field as well as we can. But Alex, you, of course, have been there. You've done how many seasons? I don't know, of Formula 2. How has the season as a whole gone from your perspective?
2023, you get different campaigns with different flavors. I really didn't know what to expect at the start of this season. This is my ninth year holding the microphone in the second tier. And you got the feeling it was going to be an experienced driver who was able to get the job done. So you had a campaign of who could take the final step. Officially, I think that is what has been borne out with what we've seen across the board. There have been some downright strange moments in the season. There have been some genuinely confusing points as well. There's also been some wonderful laps at the limit in qualifying. I think qualifying-wise, it's been a brilliant season of drivers who claim the pole position, really putting it together. But ultimately, I think we were always going to end up with an experienced champion.
Josh, from your side, I know you probably feel Formula 2 finished months ago, as most of us do. What do you remember of 2023?
It's been one of those championship battles, hasn't it? You know, those ones where just weird and wacky stuff happens to the two title contenders. Like, take Zandvoort, for instance. See, Teo Pourchaire sends it off into the sandbox, and you think, okay, Vettel's got a chance here. There's something amiss about the rear drive right now, it must be said. Just two laps later, when the wheels came off, it's just part of what makes some of these seasons what they are. A little bit like with Ilos and Schumacher a couple years ago, where just things were going back and forth all the time on the lead up to the final race. And that's pretty much what this year delivered. So, but you want to see that, you know, you don't want to see a champion decided three quarters of the way in like some other sports do. But yeah, it's with Formula 2, you're always going to get some interesting things going on, you know, whether or not the championship is decided before the final race is run. And it's just exciting watching all of these guys come up through the ranks and get to Formula 2 and just see, okay, well, now you got cars that demand a certain set of skills. Who's going to get on top of them as soon as they can? And yeah, I mean, Teo versus Frederick. Yuma was there a little bit as well. It was certainly interesting. One of the more interesting title battles in the last few years, for sure.
Perfect tonic for what we had last year as well, I think, after Felipe did such a good job. And Jack Doohan turning up really late, but I'm getting ahead of myself because the intention for this episode, everybody, is to go through the grid. And we have historically done a team-by-team analysis, which we're not going to do today. We are going to go through and try and cover every driver that we've got, though. So, in reverse order from how the championship is today on recording before the finale, we've got Josh Mason, Brad Benavidez, Roy Nissany, Americo Deal, Juan Manuel Correa, and Roman Stanek towards the bottom end. I don't really know where to start. We've got Nissany in his fifth season, still to score points. Josh Mason, somewhat like Antonelli in Joshua Dux next year. We've got a huge step up going from Euro Formula to F2. Correa, fairy tale season. It's been the comeback complete, but already doing some stuff with endurance racing, like maybe realizing Formula One might not be within reach. The bottom end drivers, for want of a better expression, Alex, how have you viewed things? Like the Nissani point, for example, it's not been the best of seasons for him.
Still made it too. So in the grand scheme of the motorsport pyramid, they've done very well indeed to make it there. But yeah, if you look across the board, there's been some flashes of brilliance from all of them. But unfortunately, just flashes. That's it. They've not had the consistency. I mean, some of them are with teams that you wouldn't expect it. I mean, I'd always take Juan Manuel Correa out of the equation purely because of everything he's been through, everything he's overcome. And for him to even come back to Formula 2, given everything that happened, that is it's absolutely impossible to convey in a short amount of time the mental tenacity that man has. And to overcome what he has. Yeah, he every single thing he achieves in motor racing is an extraordinary Herculean feat. Take it from me, that guy's a rock star. The others, look, you've got to bring a budget sometimes, and sometimes the driver on the other side of the garage enables a team to take someone that they wouldn't be able to run if not. The great example of that was Sean Galeo, really lovely chap, good guy, and he enabled Antonio Giovinazzi to run in the other car. And with that, Antonio would not have got to the upper echelons of Formula One, and he would certainly not be, Ferrari's Italian driver winning at Le Mans. So sometimes bringing the budget plays its part in other people's championships. But for the guys that you mentioned, excluding Juan Manuel, a campaign that just didn't go the way that they wanted. And I think Amaury Cordier, especially, given how well he finished last year, will be disappointed he didn't quite kick on again.
Just a point about the Josh Mason jumping in. I mean, that Spa weekend, of all the weekends you want to make your debut in this car with such a step up, we're going to see not necessarily the same, but something similar happening next year, which was the Kimi Antonelli and Dirksen thing, with going from a car which is powerful to a far more powerful car, but it's a brand new car for everybody. Alex, if I just stick with you for a second, talking about 2024 and these two drivers making such a big step up, is it going to be too big a step, or is it now the perfect time to do it?
No, I don't think it will be too big a step. There's one thing to make that step mid-season with 45 minutes and time in the sim. And even if you have access to an old car, which I don't know if that was the case or not, but obviously you're allowed to do that sometimes and do private testing. But that is just not the same as getting what those guys will get. They'll get the end of season test in Abu Dhabi. They'll get the pre-season testing in Bahrain. They'll get lots of mileage before making the step up. It won't be the sledgehammer of coming in mid-season, it's 45 minutes to go. By the way, you're at, you know, the behemoth of all motor racing tracks that modern single-seaters still race at. And that's a totally different thing. So I don't think those drivers would be making the leap if, you know, you can do damage to your career if you go through the ranks too quickly. We've seen it at all stages of motorsport. I don't think they'd be making the leap if they weren't ready. Antonelli is carrying the most hype of a driver I can remember since the I like to call it fabled because it's my favorite season ever, the Alba Norris Russell year. And that's where I think the hype levels are going to be. I found it very, very funny and almost endearing that Mercedes was saying, well, listen, let's not go hyping him too much. You know, let's not go crazy. I was like, guys, you have you've jumped him a category. That's instant hype. You know how this works. So thoroughly excited to see how that turns out, but I don't think the leap with the testing that they've got end of this year, start of next, will be too much for them.
Going to be fascinating to see. Josh, from your side of things, you have a reputation, let's call it, for being blunt and honest with lower ranked drivers. We've got a host of drivers which aren't breaching the top 17 in the championship as it stands. Do you want to have free rein here? And should we close the shutters and start protecting ourselves?
Tough love, mate. It's tough love. I'm like that grumpy PE teacher that's way too hard on their kids. It's just like, I just want you guys to succeed. that sort of way. I've got the list of drivers here that we're supposed to be talking about. Josh Mason is a good way to start here. That wasn't trial by fire. That was trial by atom bomb. I mean, apart from the obvious, not testing the car, coming straight into the category, which when that was announced, it's like, that's even for the best of drivers, the very best of drivers with all of this hype, you know, such as Antonelli, that's too much. And then he gets to Spa and he finds that the track is infested with Belgian rain. So he's got like, how long's the practice session for F2 nowadays?
45 minutes.
There's only that one practice session. Then they go to qualifying, which is the same day. Then you're into two races where in that time, apart from still learning how the car actually functions, you got to actually then work out how these tires work. So many damn things to take in mind here. So that's why with Josh, it's more like, okay, I'm not gonna be too hard on this guy because this is a massive ask for him. So it's like, just do your thing, learn your thing. I'll leave you alone. Nasani, though, he has got the experience, almost too much experience at this level, and you know. You have things like what happened in Monza with Zane Maloney. It's like, I'm not trying to say that Roy Nissany is a horrible driver because he's quick. He is quick compared to a lot of us. Like a lot of us that watch motorsport or whatever have anything to do with it, the level of even some of the lowest guys on the F2 grid is still pretty damn high in their driving caliber. So Roy can drive a bit, but it's just these instances where he keeps on ramming into other drivers, giving them way too little space on the outside. It's just like, no, the grass is the racing line too. Have some of that. It's like, how are we, after a few seasons, we still having Roy Nissany doing these kinds of things? It's like, rein it in a bit, man. Otherwise, we wouldn't have too much of a problem with you. Because there's a fair amount of times when you look at him and you think, oh, he's doing okay in the race. And then he just befalls some complete bewildering brain fate. It's like, great. I see a few seasons of this category have not benefited you in that regard. Brad Benavidez, not much happened with him. The team wasn't especially great. So there was that sort of, well, no experience. Mm. He's in a team which is not freaking Prema or ART. So, you know, he would have needed the whole season, I guess, to hone his skills and try and show something, but it just never came to fruition. So I don't know what to say about Benavidez other than just...
He's risen quick, bit fast. I don't know the reasons behind it, but it's like one season. Yeah. There's not been a lot of time to learn the car and all defensive, Brad, bless him.
Nah. So, can I keep on going for a little bit?
Please do.
Roman Stanek came in with a bit of hype. Nothing much happened. And it's been a couple of seasons now where I've been hearing about this guy, and it's like, I'm not quite seeing it right now, which is disappointing because you want to see the best in drivers, but he's coming with the legend of John Henry's hammer. And it's just like, well, it's just that legend. I'm not seeing anything come to fruition. Amaury Cordiel, pretty forgetful year, to be honest with you. So with him aside, finally circling around with Correa. Now, not entirely successful from a results standpoint, but to come back at all after what happened in 2019, that's a victory in and of itself, you know? So regardless of how the season went for him, on paper for results. Just being able to get back into the car, into an F2 car, drive the same circuit where that fateful day happened. It's courage that I know that I definitely would not be able to exhibit. Very few of us would. So just major kudos to him. And if this is the end of the road for him for F2, then hey, I'll be interested to see how he does for endurance racing.
Just a quick point with Correa, Alex, you were already bigging up a little bit, but what was it like commentating that first race in Bahrain? So he finishes P10 twice, and in the feature race, he scores points back on the F2 calendar after, what, 3 years away, was it? How did that come across? And I know you will know him, and I've spoke to him in the paddock, and he's a lovely chap. How much would that have meant to him, and how was it for you in the comms box to see that happen?
Yeah, it's one of the few things, like, commentators, because everyone gets intense and fat, it's one of the things that, how do you describe it? With one Manuel, it is a bit more emotive than it would normally be, because of the reality of that day, of knowing things behind the scenes, of having seen the brutal reality of what went on. I think 99% of people wouldn't want to sit in a car ever again, let alone sit in the same spec of car, let alone come back to the same championship, let alone come back to the same circuits. But the man is unbelievably determined, had a point to prove. I think he has proved it. You know, this is a guy who is never going to have the same braking ability as he did pre-accident. This is a guy who was finding a way to a podium on a regular basis, seemed to have a greater feeling with a Formula 2 car than he ever did in the third tier. And to have that all interrupted, you've got to remember, these are elite sports people. A personal point of pride, take the tragic events out. Personal point of pride, he is a racing driver. He wants to be competing at the front of the field. So very quickly after the, and I got to say, it's the most emotional I've ever been in the commentary box was here. You know, when outside of when things have gone really wrong on a racetrack, the most emotional I've ever been in the commentary box is when he was back in a practice session here this time last year. And I think it hit everyone like a, you know, like a hammer to see him back in exactly the same specification of car and so dogged and so determined to come back. And then, like you say, you get to Bahrain and he's a driver again, and he's annoyed that he's not able to do quite what he wants to do. And he wants to be, you know, judged by the same metrics as everyone else. I thought he's always great in Austria. He always tends to go well there. He just has a great feel for that circuit. I thought that was a great drive from him in the first race of the weekend. But, you know, I'll underline it again. For reasons that I can say and reasons that I can't, what he has done, what he continues to do, is probably the most impressive thing I've seen in the 9 years holding the microphone.
That is quite an accolade. That's a long time you've been doing it as well. We are going to move on to the, I've called them the lower midfield, the drivers a little bit further up the road in the championship at least. And speaking of injury, Ralf Bottrong to kick that off. We've also got Clement Novalak, Arthur Leclerc, Isaac Hadjar, Jack Crawford, Jehan Daruvala, Kush Maini. Now, Bottrong going on Bahrain again, to stick with that, was one position away from the elusive double win that you get in Formula 2, which was insane. And his season's tapered off significantly, but he led the championship, got the win at last. He got the P2. He's got used to the F2 podium, which is something we couldn't have said last year or before this time last year. And then we've got Novalak, who's the rival podcast host, I guess, more than he is a driver sometimes, because he's not had the best of seasons, but did get the win. Arthur Leclerc looking more comfortable in F2 than F3, in my opinion. Isaac Hadjar gets FP1s, not really done as much in F2 though. Crawford's now out of the Red Bull Junior team, which seems to be happy about. Still very young. And then Daruvala and Maini as, I don't know, the Indian representative, and Maini looking like he is a worthy successor in Formula 2 to Jehan, who's stepping away from the sport now because he's not going to be in Abu Dhabi, or he wasn't in Abu Dhabi, should I say. I don't know who you want to pick. Just pick your, take your pick out of these. Don't know where you want to start, Alex. Any of these drivers you want to particularly highlight for this year?
I can rattle through all of them. Ralph's win was fantastic. Ralph's win is, you know, there were people were questioning why is he hanging around? Why is he, you know, raising all this sponsorship money himself? That's why, to stand on the top step of the podium on a Grand Prix weekend when all the Formula One teams are milling around in the pit lane, when you've dreamt of that moment and you've been determined to get there and you actually realize it. All of the health issues that he had, all of the injury problems that he had the year before, you come back and you just look phenomenal. I mean, I don't think he cares too much about what happened for the rest of the year. He got his win. He followed it up with a podium the next day. You know, the first round of the year belonged to Ralph Boschong, and he's got that. I think that'll put a smile on his face long after he's retired and he's, you know, flying his stunt planes around like he likes to. Good for him. That was absolutely outstanding. I'd agree with your assertion that Arthur Leclerc looks happier in Formula 2 than he did in Formula 3. I think second season, he could easily take a leap forward. Looking at the other batches of drivers that were mentioned there, yeah, I think that the one that stands out is Ralph, but I want to point out Clément Novalak's win in Zandvoort. It's one of my favorite things is when you just plonk a driver back at the front and they haven't been there maybe for a while, and then suddenly they look like they're the most comfortable person on earth because they're back to where they've been in a position to climb the ladder. You have to win. You have to be at the front. And then suddenly the circumstances allowed, and he looked completely comfortable. He looked like he'd been there all season long. I think the majority of the paddock was expecting Maloney to close him down and pass him. Never got near him. Never got a sniff. Never got a hint. It does go to show the depth in talent. It does go to show that circumstances allowed, every single one of the drivers you would expect, maybe a few exceptions, but the grand majority of the field could close out a win if the circumstances allows. And good for Clément, because that was a good, who doesn't like a shock win in Formula 2?
Yeah, it's been a fun season with the amount of winners we had. I'm talking about Jack Crawford, also got the wins, been on the podium a bunch of times. He's, like I say, leaving Red Bull, but Red Bull had about 50 drivers in the junior team this year, and they seem to be cleaning house a little bit and then also picking some up as they go on as well. Ollie Goethe just recently joining as well. I'm sure Josh, as ever, has some opinions on this. The floor is yours, mate. Take what you want.
I am crashing like a DC-10 in the 70s, man. It's brutal, the time zones.
Shout out to Josh. Yes. It is past midnight in New Zealand at the moment, so thank you for
as it always is. I've also agreed to be somewhere, let's just say, at 4:30 in the morning after the race, because that's just what I do. Everything that Alex said there, with regards to Boschong, Novalak, yeah, I'd echo those as well. There are two people I want to talk about. I'll go with the nice route first. Kush Maini has adapted faster than I thought he would, and I thought he'd be pretty good heading into it. Boschong getting that almost perfect weekend in Bahrain. You know, in the background, Maini was not doing too bad. And as the season went on, we started to see Maini, I guess it's fair to say, take ground off of Boschong in the inter-team battle, which is impressive because we know Boschong's been doing well these last couple of years, you know, like damn good results. So to be able to get there, I thought was impressive. So next year, especially with the mentoring of Mika Häkkinen, who I'm still waiting for a sabbatical to end. It'll be interesting to see how he goes, really, because ultimately I did hear a bit about Kush Maini coming up through the ranks, and it's like, some saying he was better than Arjun. It's like, Arjun's pretty quick. So if the hype lines up, then that's great. And so far it's been pretty good from Kush. So keep on keeping on, Kush. You know, show us what you can do next year. Next guy I'm not going to be too nice to, Isaac Hija. I'll be blunt. What the hell does Marco see in this guy above, say, Zane Maloney? Now, I understand that Hajar's a quick guy, for sure. He had an incredible season in Formula 3, unlucky to miss out on the title. But this has not been a good year for him. This was not a good year for Hajar, which is funny considering he swept the entire round in Yas Marina, obviously, as we know. it is pretty much, we know that he's really in the good books of Marco and Red Bull. Hence, getting FP1 sessions, staying in the academy where a lot of people dropped out. But to have the season that he did, when, you know, you're having this talent drop out, and he's the lowest ranked Red Bull Junior on the grid, and I know that the inter-team battle matters, but to have this type of support behind you, I would have been expecting that this would have been put towards someone who's got something above everyone else that warrants staying in there. And I never saw that this year. I haven't seen it since the F3 season. And even then, it was kind of sketchy toward the end when the pressure got on. It's like, is this guy a Carlos Reutemann regen where he's fast as hell, but as soon as the pressure gets up, he crumples like a paper house in a windstorm? Like, I get it. That, you know, Red Bull are looking for that next big talent. They're looking for that next Vettel, the next Verstappen. I flat out don't see it with Hajar. And if he is that guy, he needs to improve massively heading into next year. Or else, Marco probably just needs to admit, okay, take a couple years out, you know, put Lawson in that seat until such time that Arvid Lindblad is ready, or someone similar. But really damn disappointing from Hajar this year. That's all I got to say on it, really.
I think it's a short sidebar, because we are talking about, well, Hajar and Crawford to an extent now, and I mean, even Jahan was part of it at some point. What is going on with the future with Red Bull? And Alex, I'd be really interested to hear your take on this. So we've had Liam Lawson jump in, and the most biased person on earth with Liam Lawson is also joining us, so be careful what you say. They've got such a depth of talent across all the championships, going all the way down to F4. And they're chopping and changing drivers at a rate which is almost unfamiliar, but they've always had a lot of drivers, but it seemed to be huge this year, then trimming down, but then replacing them. I'm not really sure what I'm asking, but the AlphaTauri seat's meant to be a feeder through, and they put Daniel Ricciardo in it when there are a whole host of drivers who could have taken it, including Liam Lawson. What gives?
I think that team's role has changed in recent years, and the mission that began in when they purchased it from Minardi has been slowly expiring to the point where Daniel Ricciardo gets put in that seat. It is no longer a junior team DNA. It's a prepare drivers for the possibility of being in the senior team, which is subtle, but I think that that is then reflected in the academy, where Red Bull have got a proud history of bringing drivers through. They've also got a proud history of chopping and changing the drivers.
Proud history.
Clearly, yeah. Well, that's how they go to work, isn't it? That's how they do it. People like it. People don't like it. There have certainly been times, speaking for myself, where I've thought certain decisions have been incredibly harsh. I don't always think that they've taken the right approach every single time. But equally, if you enter upon that academy, you know what you're signing up for. You know what the benefit is. You know that there's a pathway there, and you know that you might be given a phone call, sometimes merited, sometimes incredibly harsh, but that's the way it works. What I would say, though, is that with Hajar, for example, it feels like there's weirdly a bit more patience. It sounds really counterintuitive for so many people who've got the shop, but I think they're trusting their metrics that they see. And they always knew, you always got the feeling that, all right, Liam Lawson has been sent off to Super Formula, but you always got the feeling he was going to find himself in a Formula One car eventually. Now, he obviously did it through circumstance this year, but, you know, he's a surefire thing to be on the grid in 2025, if not before. So it feels like, even though there's a bit of change at the head of the Red Bull sporting organization in the last couple of years, it feels like the drivers that they believe in, they are giving slightly longer to, and the drivers they don't believe in, it's almost getting more aggressive on that side. And probably, you know what, we've got just too many people in the roster. We need to go for key people. And that's what they've done. But I think the it's no longer a junior team in the way that it was in the Daniel Ricciardo, Jean-Éric Vergne days. It's not that, and it hasn't been that for a while.
Josh, I don't know if you were inching close to the microphone because you were itching for something to say there in response. So your thoughts on the Red Bull Junior
team,
Marco?
Just trying to stay conscious, mate. Nah, there's another aspect to this as well.
Not the worst review I've got this year.
Oh my god. Nah, you're the best, Alex. You're the best. It's something also keeping a note here. In the years gone by, you know, when the RBJT was first founded, it was pretty much a scholarship. It's a case of, okay, we will fund your year and you go do pretty much what we commission you to do. But you go race Formula BMW, you go to F3 Euro Series, whatever. Now, as with every academy, it's all paid stuff, you know? It all varies based on which academy you go into, what exactly you're signing up for, etc., etc. But for some drivers, it's a case of, okay, we'll pay 40% of your season. You got to get 60% of that funding. It's just one example, but it could depend on all of them. So it's not the same as it used to be at the start. The question is, who are what drivers here? You know, who are the ones that are paying 100%, 50-50, or not paying at all and are being sort of led by the hand because they believe in them that much? It's, yeah, you do get the sense that they're leaning more toward the, okay, you fund primarily your season. With the Red Bull Junior team, there's a couple other academies that are like that, which I won't say or mention because it's hearsay and conjecture. And obviously I don't want to upset anybody because that's just
obviously.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I'm not quite sure with the Red Bull. Yeah. I'm not quite sure what is going on with that Red Bull team, Red Bull Junior team, because there are some strange selections in the last 24 months, you know, some good, some bad. You do also have to question as well why Isaac Hadjar was slated for an FP1 session before Ayumu Owasa, who was just as, if not more impressive than Liam Lawson has been, you know, in his time in F2. And yeah, I'm all for Liam Lawson, absolutely. And he does deserve time in Formula One. But if he deserves it, so does Ayumu Owasa. And it took until the day of this recording for that to be announced. And if that is down to what the powers that be believe in, I don't know, but I think someone probably should head toward retirement. Let's just put it that way.
Just a question. Just a question, Josh, which if we can wrap up quite quick. Do you agree with Alex's assessment that Liam Lawson is potentially the leader of the lengthy queue for a 2025 drive at some point within the, what do we call it, Racing Bulls? Is that the current working title they're talking about with Toro Rosso, whatever they're going to be?
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of drivers.
Racing Bulls, whatever it is. Yeah. Here's my thing. I reckon on the pace that he's shown already, he's got about a 10th or two, maybe three in reserve of extra pace left. That doesn't put him really that much ahead at all, if ever, of Daniel Ricciardo. I don't know if Liam is necessarily the guy that Red Bull are fully looking for, as much as blasphemy as that sounds coming from me. But I am a little bit realistic. And I think there are some Red Bull juniors coming up through the ranks who show more promise than Liam. And when they get there, you know, is going to be key.
And are if Hadjar all wins right, Josh?
What have I been drinking the last little while?
Are you okay, mate?
I'm not okay. I've had single digit total sleep since Sunday last week.
I'm also jet lagged, right? So I'm thinking, am I losing it? Are you losing it? Like, very
we're
off
both
brand
losing
right
it.
Now. Very off.
You know your time when you got two bags under your eyes. Here's a scenario for you. Imagine if Hadjar wins the championship next year. What do you think Red Bull are going to do? And unless there's a double exodus from Bulls Racing, AlphaTauri, Minardi, whatever they're called, then I can't see Liam fitting into that. And he may almost be that sort of that fringe character, that sort of nearly man that almost got into there. Look, how he drove in Formula One this year in those four rounds that he had, I wasn't expecting him to beat Yuki. Nobody reasonable was expecting that. But he did perform very well under the circumstances, and that's all you can ask of the guy. But we know how Red Bull are. We know their knee-jerk reactions. They're almost as bad as me. So if Hadjar wins the championship next year, and with how much they're believing in him, and also there's a Yuma Owasa in Super Formula. Like, there are two people here, at least, that can cause a problem. And what if Zane Maloney wins the championship next year? And all of a sudden Marco says, oh, you know what? I was wrong to drop you. How about you come in next year? We don't know. It's a year out, over a year out from this decision being made. So anything can happen in that time, which is why I'm, you know, they say, oh, Liam's guaranteed a seat for 2025. It's like, that's cute. I'll believe it when I see it, because guarantees in the sport are nothing. Jaime Alguersuari was meant to come back to F1 in 2011.
Yeah, I don't think he's been given a guarantee. This is turning into a Liam Lawson podcast. I don't think
Josh Rebels on what you expect.
Yeah. I don't think they've given him a verbal guarantee, but I think he did enough in his time in the sport to book himself back in. Because the one thing working against everyone that we've discussed, everyone we're going to discuss in the next half of the podcast, is that the most important thing by far is winning the paddock over with F1 experience. And Liam did a phenomenal job in, if you consider that Logan Sargeant, you know, back in Vegas, phenomenal qualifying lap when it really mattered. He's been inching closer to that contract renewal. You know, the team have been giving him all the time. Liam condensed an entire season of winning hearts and minds into a couple of weeks. And I think he shifted, not skeptics, but you've got to remember that in Formula One, there is a massive disparate opinion on even the very, very quickest drivers. So you're always winning someone over when you do well. And his performance in Singapore was outstanding. It was just absolutely outstanding. It's such a tricky track where, you know, hypothetical lap times are sometimes as much as 0.6 of a second faster, but drivers can't hook it all up. I thought he did a great job. So that's why I think potentially, because that Formula One seat time, I just think is worth so, so much for perception in the paddock.
Shall we move away from talking about the Red Bull junior team to talk about the upper midfield with, Zane Maloney, Dennis Hauger, Enzo Fittipaldi, Richard Vachon, Ollie Bearman, and Victor Martin are also part of what I've deemed the upper midfield. And decent seasons for all of them, I would say, which is why they're in that point. Hauger, maybe we can argue about expectation from a couple of years ago coming into F2 as a champion, but he can't emulate Drugovic in the same car as he lost his chance at reaching the top. But then you also have Zane and Enzo at Carlin, where it seems to be like scales. One of them does well, one of them does badly, and it neither can do well at the same time. Are they missing something at Carlin? I don't know. Vachon, one of the most poignant moments of the season. I thought you talked about emotion earlier, Alex, that winning in Austria that weekend for that country, if you want to think of it from a national pride point of view, we've had Braun the Impossible Dream come out, and it's almost as unbelievable as that in a way that he does that and dedicates a victory to Delano. That was the most emotional point of the season for me. And then on a high, Behrmann and Martin, who could easily be up there in the championship hunt, if not for rookie errors pretty much earlier in the season, as well as not so much of a rookie error. Was it Jeddah with a certain Théo Pourchaire deciding to end for Ollie's race, but then Ollie coming back with Baku and being sensational. Alex, again, floor is yours. You can pick any of that if you would like to go on a high, go on a low, anything. There's a bunch of decent drivers there, I'd say.
Some terrific drivers here. I would say that I think Zane Maloney will be slightly frustrated with the way that the season has panned out. He's definitely one that you can file under had more pace than the results page shows. Richard Vachon's entire season boils into that unbelievable final stint. How many times in Formula 2 do we see drivers with theoretical tire advantages? And you know, I must have said probably hundreds of times by now, literally hundreds of times by now, they've got a great opportunity to try and take the win here. And no one ever goes and does it. No one ever goes and slices past everyone. That was outstanding to get past everyone. All right, you needed a moment of fortune with the timing of the safety car. Executed the moves brilliantly, held off a Wasa. The roar from the grandstands was F1 levels for an F2 race. I've seen that happen when Antonio Giovinazzi won from 21st on the grid, Monza. But that's right up there with the best atmosphere I've ever heard for a Formula 2 race. And I don't know, just it makes you fall in love with it all over again. You're like, can this guy racing with, you know, such a heavy heart deliver? And when he does, that is the epitome of motor racing. Can the driver deliver on the day?
Yeah. After the year before he had as well with Austria, the same race. And I mean, I don't know if he even gave the trophy back in the end, because I know he's hiding it. Was it from Logan Sargeant?
So I love that. I think Hauger's been a little bit unlucky, contact here and there. And he seems to be a driver that really builds momentum, and the confidence comes with the momentum, and momentum pushes the confidence. And when it clicks for him, as we've seen in Formula 3, he's absolutely devastating. But just too many results in the middle of the year that weren't, just not enough podiums. Simple as that. So pleased that Enzo Fittipaldi got his win. He's deserved that for a long time. Giant killing rookie season. And then it's a different challenge, isn't it, when you get into your next year and you're expected to be on the podium every single week. That can mess with the driver's head a bit. Oliver Behrmann, if you consider that he's won four races in his rookie season, and Lando won one in 2018, despite consistently being in contention, I think that shows you everything he's done. Victor Martin's just so quick, it's silly sometimes. And he looks like he's doing what he did in Formula 3. He's bedded himself in nicely. He's shown a lot of promise, and you'd be astonished if he wasn't a full contender for the title next year.
Yeah, he is. Those latter two in particular really impressed me, and I was umming and ahhing whether I put them into the top place drivers, but they're just under the championship hunt. Unless one of them becomes a vice champion this weekend, in which congratulations, Ollie, for being vice champion, rookie season, well done. Though, no, we've got Josh. I think you'd probably be a bit more forgiving on some of these names because they've had good seasons. I think Alex is correct in that Zane, out of that lot, had more pace, and for whatever reason, it didn't work out for him. But all of them should they return for next year, I would imagine should be fighting for those upper positions.
Yeah, with Zane, he was all over the place in terms of where he would be on the pecking order. Sometimes he'd be up there, sometimes he'd be in no man's land, which is understandable because debuting in F2 is tricky for the best of people. So it could have just been, I'm not sure what it was that caused that sort of disparity. Early part of the season, he was looking like $1 million. Then mid part of the season, the disparity between he and Enzo was quite a lot. I still think it's wrong that he was dropped from the Red Bull Academy, although we don't quite know what the reasons were. So I don't know. For sure, again, echo the exact same sentiments that Alex had, because, you know, I'll just what Alex said, I can't say any better with regards to the shore this year. So, yeah, but like, that's just pretty much it. Just deeply emotional weekend that was, and it was just what motor racing is all about. Like he said, Helga, just I don't know, like, we just have these, we had this hype going into the campaign last year off of his F3 title. It didn't quite happen. Then he moved over to MP, who had the package last year, and again, it didn't materialize. And now he's been dropped by Red Bull. He's going to be independent for next year. And I believe I'm right in saying, is he going to be Colapinto's teammate?
For this weekend, or last weekend, I don't know if we've had the announcements for next year. Alex maybe knows. I would be surprised if it wasn't.
I'm going to do the most professional thing in the world and Google it.
I've always got Wikipedia up in the middle of a podcast, the most trustworthy source on the internet. So don't worry about it. But
Can confirm that indeed he is going to be his teammate for next season. So that's going to be tough. And I don't know if Helga is going to find his mojo in that time. He's got to find it quick because Colapinto does get in his feet relatively quickly in new categories. Touch wood. I've just jinxed him again. I guess you're going to call it a disappointing season for him because we did expect quite a bit. We did expect him to be challenging for the title and he did not do that. So, personally, I would write it off as a bit of a disappointment. Enzo Fittipaldi, after last year, what he did with Chiru, with Trials, expected that to carry over to perhaps a better team. Didn't quite hit those heights. But then again, Maloney was struggling as well. So it was a bit difficult to work out where exactly they were. I guess, I don't know. It's a bit of an enigma with those two. Expected a bit, they didn't quite deliver the results that we wanted to. Now onto the two drivers that I'm keen to get into. The Bear, Ollie Bearman. Hell of a first year in the category. To be winning the races that he did, or was it four wins, did you say?
Including the double at Baku.
Yeah, four wins.
Yeah. Four wins in your debut season. He's with Prema, but had it not been for his struggles, I believe at the beginning of the year, he definitely could have been a contender for the championship because there were more than one weekend where he was clearly better than Vesti in that respect. And that's mega impressive to be on that form already. So next year, you got to say he's going to be a contender for the title. Absolutely. No question about it. Even with the mega lineup that is potentially at Prema or wherever he lands up. Great stuff from the Bear. Victor Martins. Man, this guy's going to replace Colapinto on my fan list in a second because that guy this season, to be going up against Teo Porcher immediately out of the box and to be performing against him like he did. Like, F3 was no fluke. and again could have been a contender for the title had the earlier part of the season been a bit more clean. So it's, I'm just dying to see how he's going to do next year. These two, the Bear and Victor Martin, I think for 2024, if they can keep a good, consistent year ahead of them, we know they got the pace to deal to do with it because we saw that this year. So yeah, like bring on 2024 because this year showed that those two can hustle a car against the best of them in F2 who have had experience. And yeah, I think it'll be an interesting season next year with what we've seen this year.
This is going to be maybe a controversial statement. I do want to move on to the final four, but those two in particular, looking through the grid this year, I don't know what the grid's fully going to be like for next year. I would argue that those two are the drivers I'm most expecting to actually reach Formula One compared to everybody else. And that includes Porsche and Vesti, which I'm not sure. I don't know where the Alpine stuff goes with Victor. Behrmann at Haas, I think, is almost inevitable if he does well next year as well as we expect. Josh, am I delirious thinking this? But those two for me are the current highest potential drivers in Formula 2.
If anyone's delirious, it's going to be me right now, mate. I'm just hoping that what I'm conveying right now is actually English. For all I know,
you said that Victor Martin might be ahead of Colapinto, so I don't know if that is English for a sentence from yourself.
Okay, scrub that. I'm speaking gibberish.
No. Also, didn't you say that Liam Lawson's Formula One career was over, Josh? I mean, that's I thought that was potentially too spicy myself, but
is it that delirious just knowing how harsh Red Bull can be when it comes to their musical chairs? Like,
you'll be allowed to stay part of the fan club.
He's gonna get kicked out of the country at this rate, hating on Liam Lawson. How dare you?
National treasure, Liam Lawson will not accept it.
I'm one of like four people in this country that did not blame the referee in the final. So there we go.
That's very good.
There we go. I'm a proud Kiwi at heart, but unlike a lot of them, I'm not that delusional. Anyway, what was your original question?
Victor Martin, Ollie Behrmann, are they the ones who are destined for greatness from this current grid?
Well, Behrmann's already looking good in with Haas now already, isn't he? And
yeah, they were really impressed with him during FP1.
Yeah, so there's that. And I'm not sure exactly how much sponsorship he's going to bring to Haas if they do offer him that seat, but they're kind of treading water with their sort of regular drivers, I guess, which is extremely harsh because we know how good Hulk and Mag are, but it sort of seems like they're not getting anywhere really with those two. So will they take a punt on Behrmann? Who knows, but they probably need to think about going a different route if what they know isn't working. With Victor Martins, he just looks like he's got the package to make it in this game. And again, he was impressive right away, right from the damn start. And I think, especially by Melbourne, I was like, is this guy actually going to challenge for the title straight out of the box? You got that sense. There was just, you know, the odd error, which played against him massively. Because in the second half of the season, like, you know, but if he was only about 10 points adrift of the lead going into Monza, then the form he was carrying through the entire time, you would think, okay, this guy can actually win this championship. His speed's been bloody impressive. And if Alpine really want that next big star to come through their academy, they've honestly got to zero in on this guy and make him a priority. There's going to be an Australian out there who's going to violently disagree with me. Not that will be the first time we've had a crossword. Alpine do have two very good candidates here, but if I had to pick one of them, I'd have to go with Victor because this year he went above the expectation that I had for him. And that's saying a lot. So yeah, if you had to say Behrmann and Martin are more likely for F1 glory than Porsche and Vesti, a little, you know, like Porsche's hanging in a bit there. I know Merck have a bit of confidence in Vesti, but I'd have to agree with you on that one.
Alex, you may know more than we do. Briefly, is there anything for those two you think might have Formula One in their future?
Yeah, I think they've both got an opportunity next year to force their way into to Formula One. I think it's that simple. I think there is a pathway there for both of them. And yeah, it's in a really nice situation. Sometimes in motor racing, it's not down to you. Sometimes you need happenstance and luck and fortune and things to break your way. But I actually think that they can go and seize their opportunity next year if they can put impressive seasons together. And it's worth underlining that as well. That wouldn't just be placement in the championship. That would be impressive seasons all the way through.
I'm hearing the short version of Jim. I completely agree with your right. So I will stick with that as your answer. Final drivers and top place drivers, the top four, as it currently stands pre-Abu Dhabi, and it's all subject to change. But we have misfortune or late bloomer, I don't know, but Jack Doohan coming up very late, and he could have been a championship challenger. He's one of my favourites for the title, but if we scrub off the first half of the season, he would be. But Jack Doohan, Ayumu Wasser, Fred Vesti, Teo Pourchaire, late resurge for Doohan, like I mentioned. Iwasa close to the top two, championship challenger. We've already discussed if it's possible for AlphaTauri. We'll see. And then I said throughout the season, early as well, Vesti versus Pourchaire. And I don't know who wins the title at this point. I mean, it's clearly, as we record, Pourchaire in the driving seat. I thought Vesti might be the better driver, but there's just something about fortune and luck, which I do believe in, that I just thought Pourchaire is going to get this just because if we go to Vegas, I would bet on Pourchaire to win big ahead of Vesti. And I don't know what that is. Maybe you, Alex, can, with all your experience, can pick up what I'm trying to portray, that, or I'm trying to convey, should I say, that you've got two very good drivers, almost like Verstappen and Leclerc, but Leclerc is unlucky and Pourchaire is lucky. Do you understand what I'm saying? That he was always more destined to win the title?
I think you've got to look at the approach that they took. Teo Pourchaire, I think in his second season, was massively stung by the campaign he put together. And I think he resolved pretty clearly. Saw him at the start of the year. We had him in the commentary box for F1 testing. And I was like, this guy is in a completely different headspace to the previous season. And clearly had mapped out his approach. And as soon as he went into the side of Oli Behrmann in Jeddah, his entire championship teetered on the brink there and then. Because he was either going to respond to that with the maturity of a third season, or he was going to try and make up for it in the next rounds that appeared. And he's taken what I like to call the Esteban Ocon approach to it, where he was like, podiums will get me in the mix and I'm just going to mark off my rivals. He's taken the management of the points approach and it's given him the status of champion elect going into the final round. He's in a great position to close out that title, but it was I think it was a complete conscious choice. If he had to win in Belgium, there would have been an aggressive all-in win or bust wheel-to-wheel with Doohan. He could let Doohan go. He did let Doohan go. He's been in that championship management mindset for a really, really long time. And so whilst it looks a bit daft that you've got just one win in the win column for him, that was a conscious decision. That was a response to not making the leap in his second year. And he could have let it all unravel after a pretty sloppy accident, let's be honest, with Oliver Behrmann at the start of the year. Instead of that, he galvanized from that point. And I know what you mean about Vesti's luck. You know, drops it on the install lap in Spa. Two wheels come off the wagon in Zandvoort. And a move that, I mean, how many times have we seen that? And it's fine. Into the first Lesmo in Monza. Those different stories, even if those rounds
yield 30 points. He's the leader, and we've got a barnstormer. You know, even if he'd had an average feature races, and you get the feeling he would have been on the podium in those feature races. So tough one for him to swallow down, but I think he knows that he's shown he's driving class. Again, I talked with about Behrmann and Martins. It's not just the way, it's not where you finish only, it's the performances you put together. And Frederik Vesti, you know, obviously second favorite to take the title, but he can be very, very pleased to be a five-time winner. He's shown some terrific performance. He's changed the narrative from what we saw in that first season. He clearly gets on with the team brilliantly. And that's the Vesti we knew from before. That was a driver, you know, that was a driver with a smile on his face at the top end of his capabilities. And that's all you can ever ask. Sometimes it goes your way, sometimes it doesn't go your way, but can you show your ability at the top level? And he has done that. Win or lose this weekend, he's shown his potential on the Grand Prix weekend, and I think that's what he was looking for after last season.
Just a point before we move on to Josh's assessment as well on the other two drivers. So Wasa, which we kind of spoke about a little bit, and Jack Doohan, poor Jack Doohan, as I'm referring to it, because I did think he had a terrific year as well, especially when he got it all working for him. Good seasons from them both.
Absolutely. I think Wasa probably hasn't had the ultimate pace as much as you would need to contend for the title. He's got it to go to the final round. Mathematically, that's a very good performance in your second season. I felt that he would be a contender in more feature races than he was, but I was very, very impressed with his ability to sometimes win when he didn't have the fastest car. So I think he can be proud of his campaign. And for Jackie Doohan, I think it's just simply a case of if the first half of the season had gone to plan, if he'd been racing with the full capabilities of, we know that brilliant team there and what they can do. I think if everything had been firing the way he would have wanted, the way the team would have wanted, then he absolutely would have been a contender. He did well to get close. He did well to go on a tear. And I wonder if he will think in future years, man, if I just tiptoed through those first moments of Zandvoort, I might have been able to come back and be a contender. But it's good that he got back to race winning ways.
Good way to assess that. Josh, for the class of the field, Jack might not be in the top four by the end of it, but the other three almost certainly will be, barring some, well, it's Formula 2, so God knows what could happen this weekend. But Porsche, Vesti, Wasa, Doohan, your thoughts?
Yeah, I did think Doohan was going to be more of a factor this year. But that was a dreadful start to the season.
Yeah.
However, it came about, misfortune, mistakes, whatever it was, you got to make your own luck in this game, for better or for worse. Like, we could talk about the reliability issues, perhaps, of Porsche in 2022, but it doesn't change the fact that those results are final. They're going to happen. You're going to have to deal with them if you want that championship charge. And, I mean, we've seen it, obviously, this season, as Alex alluded to, has been completely different from Teo through how he's approached it. Now, a lot of people are saying, oh, this is boring, you know, title battle. Or at least I've seen some people say that, because here we got one guy that's won multiple races throughout the year, yet he has an outside chance heading into the final round of beating a dude who won the first race and didn't win anything after that. But it's, again, proof that it's the long game. It's the consistency. It's every single thing you got to have working for you in this championship hunt. And he's just been getting those points all the time, almost Scott Dixon-esque, where it's like, even if he doesn't have the outright pace, he just banks those points all the time. Then you get to like the last two races, it's like, well, wait, where'd you come from? Like, I didn't see you all the way up there all the time, yet here he is. And, you know, those last two, last little bit, he can draw on the experience and the confidence heading into it to his benefit. ART did start off as the best team, I guess, at the start of the year. They had a damn rocket ship. That was not replicated in any of the other rounds. You could definitely make a point that Prema had the better package throughout the year. But again, Martin was still, you know, showing that they can go toe-to-toe with Prema. And Porsche was still putting in those good performances, again, getting solo points in both of each race and the sprint race. You know, we could talk about misfortunes, such as, should we say, the loss of rear traction for Vessi and Zandvoort. But for the majority of the time, Porsche has just been honing in and getting those points. Yeah, the odd slip up, such as in Zandvoort, but yeah, it's got that feel of a back and forth season, which is what you want to see. It's similar to Ilott and Schumacher 2020, where it sort of yo-yoed all the way down to the final flag. So yeah, Ayumu Iwasa, he, you know, after last year, you would have expected a bit of an improvement. I didn't sense that much of an improvement from Iwasa this year, at least in pure pace. Maybe not. Maybe I'm looking at it wrong. Solid as hell, as we would have expected him to be. And for next season to be in Super Formula, it'll be interesting to see how that goes. Because, you know, he'll be at home. You know, he'll have the familiarity of the circuits. And knowing how Liam did, it'll be tough, because we know how good Tomoki Nojiri is and how competitive that season full stop is. But yeah, I think he definitely made an impression in his time in Formula 2, irrespective of where he, you know, finished winning the championship or not. I think he can take pride in what he's done. Because just with his drives alone, he struck a chord with a lot of people in the fan base. You know, there were a lot of people that were clamoring for his berth on the Formula One grid. So that's all you could do. Like we alluded to earlier, you've got to win over people in the paddock with your performances. You know, you could finish 16th on the grid, but if your car was so bad to a point where you would have gotten lapped, you know, every 10 laps, and you didn't, you know, have that happen to you, people will notice. People in the paddock do have an eye for this stuff. So undoubtedly Iwasa did that. So, you know, that's all one can really do. But otherwise, you know, I think the title battle that we had this year was intriguing, you know, right down to the last. And you know, that's all we want. We want a title battle that goes down to the wire, with some bumps along the way for, you know, entertainment purposes, I guess. But it does bring out the best in people. It's, you know, diamonds are made under pressure and all that jazz.
Good way to sum all that up. I'm going to wrap up in a second. I just want to give the final word to you, Alex. With quite a difficult question, I think. So apologies, but we are facing next year, unless Logan Sargeant does get dropped and Porsche is all of a sudden into Williams, with the prospect that Drugovich, Porsche / Vesti aren't in Formula One. We've had Liam Lawson reach there, but not there. And Iwasa doing, Josh and I at least agreed that are unlikely to be there next year. Is there something to worry about with Formula 2? Or is this just, as you suggested, with the AlphaTauri team changing its purpose, the culmination of these academies, and you have to be aligned with a team to get to the top, and the lack of opportunities? Is it just a culmination of a lot of different factors which is affecting it, or are we struggling on talent?
No, we're definitely not struggling on talent. I would say that the way the pendulum has swung in the last few years, it's never been harder to be a rookie in Formula One. And Nico Hülkenberg is the perfect example of this. Teams are just going for known quantities, and we only have 20 cars on the grid. Now, if we had 26 cars on the grid, let's say the 90s, you'd get an opportunity for
far more drivers to get strapped into the car and show what they could do and maybe pull a unbelievable qualifying performance out of the bag. Or if you look at what Fernando Alonso did, it's a great example, in a Minardi in 2001. You know, if you look at the actual results, not that spectacular, but if you could see what he was doing and the paddock could see what he was doing, then that's the bedrock for him having the longest ever Formula One career. Whereas because we're down to 20 on the grid, you've got, which is no bad thing, and Formula One's in a wonderful place, but the nature of it means that the pendulum has swung away from the rookie driver is the short answer to it. And it means that you have to do more than just find your way to the front eventually. You've got to write headlines. You've got to do a Piastri. You've got to do a Leclerc. You've got to do a Russell. Or you've got to be in a year where the entire paddock rates absolutely every driver in the top six. You know, my favorite season, I mentioned this earlier, my favorite season is 2018, where you had Albon, Norris, and Russell. So all three podium contenders, one a winner. Lando will definitely be a winner. If Alex Albon gets the right race one day, he absolutely has the ability to execute that and stand on the top step. So that's the caliber of driver, but it's the perception of the caliber of driver that now means that there is so much demanded. And when you get rookie champions, Leclerc, Russell, and Piastri, when you get that, the standard, twinned with the fact that rookies, you know, there's not a lot of testing time. Long, rambly answer to say, it's never been harder to be a Formula One rookie. It's not a reflection on Teo and Vesti and Awasa doing Martins and Behrmann, but it is to say that you've got to take your chance. Your window is quite small compared to previous years. For example, and I'm not digging him out, he's one of my favorite drivers ever, but Damon Hill's junior career was nothing to write home about. How did he get himself into the best car of the day? Got himself into the best car of the day because there was unlimited testing. And that era has changed the type of grid we have and the type of talents that we see. Damon Hill winning the world championship is one of the great emotive stories in Formula One history. It probably wouldn't play out the same way in this day and age. So you've got to just say we're in a different era. And at the moment, it's an era that's not the friendliest to the rookie. It does mean, though, that when a driver does put a campaign together that gets into Formula One, you have watched something truly special, like we had a couple of years ago with Oscar Piastri.
Can I ask then, as the final question, I promise on this one, you are now tasked with being the consultant for FIA to say, how do we get more rookies into the sport? And I think personally that the FP1 sessions that they are mandating is such a good initiative. They need to have more, 3-4 per car per season, potentially. Yeah. Do you see something as simple and easy to implement as that being the solution, or do you have other out-the-box ideas?
That is exactly, I didn't know you were going to say that, but that's exactly what I would do. We're recording this the day before we're about to put 10 different drivers in the field for FP1. I think on a weekend where you wouldn't want to do it if there was only one session, but you know, 3 hours of practice is pretty much on the brink of too much anyway, if we consider that we send our Formula 3 drivers and Formula 2 drivers out in 45 minutes. So 3 hours, I'd love to see more mandated FP1 rookies and just get, because worst case scenario, drivers who've put their heart and soul into a career, families haven't taken holidays, all they've done is they've followed to kart tracks. You know, it's not just the drivers put their entire lives into this, it's their families, it's their siblings, it's their parents. You still get that day where they come out of the garage as a Formula One driver. Worst case scenario. Best case scenario, the team go, tell you what, and Isaac Hadjar is a great example of this. He's not had the best F2 campaign, but he did everything we asked for him. There was good baseline pace there. He ran the tires incredibly consistently. That's changed the perception. That's exactly what happened with Isaac Hadjar when we ran him in Mexico in FP1. So more of that, I completely agree. I would say, you know, look, we've got 24 races. We can afford 5 FP1s where one team has to, you know, one garage has a different driver.
I am thinking then that we go for FP1 sessions for all rookies and we do it at sprint weekends, and then I'll be more invested in a sprint weekend where there's no practice for the drivers. I will let you both go. And Josh, I know you are extremely flagging. Thank you so much for staying up late. Alex, thank you again for joining us. You've been excellent all year, and I look forward to hearing you this weekend or last weekend when this goes out. That is all the time we have this week. Thank you, everybody else, for watching and listening. If you're watching on YouTube, drop a like on the video, leave a comment, and subscribe. It all really helps us out. And if you're listening, please leave a review on the podcast platform you're listening on. It's greatly appreciated. And finally, check out feederseries.net for more Feeder Series insights, and follow feeder_series, FS Americas, and Feeder Series Now on Twitter. You can find the links to all of those, plus the Twitter accounts for myself and everyone else in the podcast, in the YouTube description or the podcast show notes. Until next time, we've been the Feeder Series Podcast. Goodbye.